This episode of East Meets West is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings and billing clarity for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchased at emw.ting.com. Welcome to East Meets West, episode 298. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Zhang.
Roger's been partying.
I've been engaging in the festivities and celebrations over my company's new launch of a new channel of shows.
The Tech Feed.
The Tech Feed. It's a very
generic. Did you have to pay BuzzFeed any royalties for that?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Because we didn't have to pay BuzzFeed any royalties for Buzz Out Loud. But actually, we predated BuzzFeed. So BuzzFeed didn't pay us any royalties for BuzzFeed at Buzz Out Loud.
Well, you would have to go to court and see how the presiding judge...
Nobody wants to do that.
No. It's too much.
I see you have a new Skype avatar.
Yes. It's a lovely avatar created by the super talented Stephanie Lantry, who actually lives down in L.A. In between her job, she's also a very talented artist and who you will often find at Comic-Con, WonderCon, and Emerald CityCon up in Seattle with their own booth selling their comic Conjoined Comics, which is, what is their series called? Yeah, To the Power.
So is it you?
Yes, it's me. So it's my Halloween avatar. And it is me as the evil Sulu from the Dark Mirror Universe where
she gave
you
a nice prominent chin.
I have a nice prominent chin.
I mean, you totally have a prominent chin.
And the comic is the comic you should check out that they write. She draws and her partner Carrie writes is called To the Power Against. You like Buffy with mathematics? It's great.
Oh. Buffy with mathematics?
Yes.
So instead of stakes?
Instead of stakes, it's equations.
Ah. So she kills monsters with equations.
She solves problems with equations.
What kind of problems? Math problems?
So, yes.
You're not doing a very good job of explaining this, Roger.
So, check it out. Go to conjoinedcomics.com/books.
/books,
BOOKS. And they have previews, and it's all there. It's so much better than me trying to do a very poor job of describing.
But what about the people out there who are like, I don't want to go to conjoined?
You know what? You're on a freaking computer. Go visit the website.
All right, and there's an E in conjoined, folks.
Yes.
Don't forget that. /books. To the Power Against.
Yes.
Catalina Jones is a mild-mannered probabilistic risk assessor. Her life was relatively normal. She had a fiancé, a cat, and one big jerk of a boss. But now, thanks to the fallout from a bizarre microwave burrito graviton missile accident, she also has the power to control probability itself. You didn't tell me that. That's amazing. This new power is wild, thus far unpredictable, and potentially deadly. With the help of her friend Zi Chen, she must learn to control her abilities before she destroys her whole neighborhood, or worse, the universe, and attracts too much attention from the creepy guys in dark suits. Okay, so she uses the power of probability to fight the powers of evil. That sounds awesome.
Yes, I told you it's a much better...
You said she solves problems, like math problems. I'm like, no, there's got to be more to it than that, because
yes.
That just sounds like someone doing their homework.
That's true. Although, that would be a great kids show, like MathNet in the day.
Well, that would be 3-2-1 Contact.
No, MathNet. You never watched Square One TV?
Oh, MathNet. Yeah, no, I did, actually. I did watch
it. It's a spinoff of, or not spinoff, it's a parody of Dragnet, except with math.
Yeah, I remember MathNet. I thought that was a 3-2-1 Contact thing. It was a Square One thing?
Square One TV. So Square One TV. Hmm. So for anyone not familiar with American public broadcasting, 3-2-1 Contact, a show that Tom is referring to, was a science show designed for kids basically from grade school up into junior high. And it was started, I think, in the late 70s, 77, 78, and it kind of continued out into the late 80s. I think at the last season, there was a co-production between a French broadcaster and PBS, which is why a lot of those episodes were shot in France. But Square One TV came around in the 90s or late 80s. So late 80s, early 90s, that period. And what was so great about it is they hired, it was shut down in LA, but they hired a bunch of comedy writers and stand-up comedians and you know, people who were very used to doing doing sketch comedy, and they basically created a sketch comedy show around math. So they would talk about things like prime numbers, but they would use skits to kind of explain the principles behind certain things, certain mathematical concepts.
So yeah, I liked that. I liked MathNet.
It was great. And MathNet was one of the reoccurring skits they had. And this was, I think, shot outside of that main core group of people, but essentially it was kind of a drama-esque, you know, dramedy-style MathNet. You know, two detectives go out and solve various cases using math. And it's great. It's just, if you actually watch it, just to watch it by itself and without any kind of desire to learn about anything about math, you just watch it, it's really entertaining. I mean, I still watch it on YouTube.
Well, I remember I was watching those shows because my brother, who's 7 years younger than me, was watching them. And it was sort of this thing where, you know, I was too cool for school because I was the older brother. But I would get sucked in because they were just well-written.
They were well-written. They had, you know, incredible song and dance numbers. And you know, for people not familiar with PBS, traditionally PBS, outside of Sesame Street and a couple of other shows, they weren't big-budget productions. They were solid productions, but they just didn't, you know, they weren't splurging money left and right.
You mean big-budget productions.
Yes, Big Bridget Productions. You know, they did a very, very good job. The writing was good. The personalities, the people themselves, the actors were really good. And, you know, I've always wondered, it's like, could they ever bring something like that back again? Something where you learn the various, you know, it's an educational show where so you learn something. But it's done in a manner does... And this is the one thing I so appreciate about that show, is that it never felt like it was talking down to you just because you were a kid and you needed kind of the pat on the head and to talk real slow and use very simple concepts. It took a base fact that, yeah, you understood what addition was and subtraction was. I thought it was very well done.
It
was smart. And as an adult, you can watch it and still appreciate it. It doesn't feel like, oh, I'm watching a kid's show.
No, the best kids shows are like that. Not just because adults then enjoy watching it with their kids, but children don't feel talked down to and they don't feel like they should be embarrassed for watching it.
Yes.
That's how I felt when I was a kid and I was just old enough to be embarrassed that I was watching a kid's show, but I wasn't too old to actually get something out of it. And so the fact that it was well written and it didn't talk down to me made me feel like, oh no, this is just really good stuff. You know, I'm not being a kid. I'm not being immature.
Let me ask you this. As a child, did you ever find yourself watching, like, I would say adult shows, like, you know, when I say
Playboy
adult.
Playboy Channel.
Not Playboy, but like, you know, shows that older audiences would like. So for example, my cousins, or at least one, the one cousin, was a big fan of the old, you know, Fred Astaire movies, a lot of the movies that came out of the 50s, 60s, Maltese Falcon. And he was only in junior high, but he enjoyed watching. So every time we went over to, you know, my aunt and uncle's house, you know, after dinner, we would be watching all these shows, which, you know, I didn't think were the most enjoyable. I'd rather watch Wonder Woman or Solid Gold. But, you know, I was wondering if he did it on purpose or if he actually enjoyed it. I'm wondering if there are other people out there that actually kind of, you know, enjoy watching something that's not targeted at their age bracket.
Yeah, no. In fact, it's interesting that you bring that up because all through my childhood, I watched what you're describing of as adult programming mixed in with kids programming. I mean, I definitely watched Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street and Electric Company and all these shows. But on the weekends, after the cartoons were over, I would watch the Bowery Boys. I would watch Ma and Pa Kettle. I would watch Godzilla movies. I would watch Abbott and Costello. I'd watch Fred Astaire. If you brought up Fred Astaire, I'd watch Fred Astaire movies. I'd watch Star Trek, the original series. You know, this is all definitely from age six or seven on, you know, definitely before high school. So that doesn't seem unusual to me at all, because that's just what we watched. And it's an era for me when we didn't have cable. We didn't get cable until I was 12 or 13, I think. So you watched what was on, and there were five channels in St. Louis, basically. We had the three major networks, and we had two independent channels, Channel 11 and Channel 30. So that's what you had to choose from. And so we watched a lot of adult programming during the day, and then primetime programming. You know, we'd watch things like Little House on the Prairie, which are sort of all ages programming. And there were certain things like, I remember Soap, we were not allowed to watch because it was too adult. But
Soap, I'm trying to remember which one Soap was.
Soap was the situation comedy with a gay character and
okay, yeah,
single people having relationships, you know, something totally normal for, you know, in this era where we have shows like Modern Family, but it was considered very racy back then. So we weren't allowed to watch that, but we pretty much watched anything. MASH and stuff was on. We'd sit there and play on the floor while we watched it. So to me, it didn't feel like I was watching adult programming. It felt like there was only kids programming on at certain times, and we watched kids programming then, and at the other times we watched whatever else was on.
You know, it's really interesting because, you know, I did have a sense I was, like, when we were watching Hitchcock movies, my cousin, my oldest cousin, were big Hitchcock fans. So we, like, when we went out to the theater, we would go, like, see, like, North by Northwest. It wasn't like, you know, some of the latest kiddie movie or even Blockbuster. It was like these old classics. But for some reason, oh, not for some reason, but I honestly felt like I was being a lot more mature. Like, you know, I was being an adult. I was watching, you know,
sophisticated,
exactly. I was watching a sophisticated movie that, you know, that didn't even have color. You know, I thought, wow, I must have really refined taste.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost like it's so old. I definitely remember feeling that too when my parents would watch those Fred Astaire movies or the musicals. My mom watched a lot of musicals on the weekends that were on TV, Bing Crosby stuff, Frank Sinatra movies, Humphrey Bogart movies even, which are fantastic movies, film noir classics. Watched all that stuff and I felt like, oh yeah, I'm being mature because I'm watching black and white movies that the old people watch.
And ironically, in a very roundabout way, you know, my further interest in those was spurred on in high school by the fact that around that time they were releasing a lot of the old 1930s serials on VHS tape, so I could rent it out from the video store. But things like the old Buck Rogers, the old Flash Gordons, and granted, they were meant for kids, and you watch them, they're kind of silly, but what I appreciate about them so much was, and this is my personal take on it, is that as society moves through various time periods, that content, the entertainment programming, is a reflection, I think, of what the maybe zeitgeist is too strong of a word, but kind of what people, you know, thought of the world. Like, for example, back in the early 1900s, people thought, you know, Mars was inhabited by a threatening race of aliens. You know, you could go to the moon. You know, space travel was just around the door. You know, because manned flight was just accomplished. It's like, how much longer till we reach the moon and the rest of the planets? But you know, it was very telling. I mean, just the way, you know, how the villains and the heroes were depicted, as well as who the heroes and the villains were. And so I thought it was just very instructive. I enjoy that because I think it's a very unique way of kind of getting a insight into that period of time. Like, you know, if you watch the 80s, a lot of the sitcoms and shows and stuff, everything was very glamorous in a way. Like even detective shows. I'm not sure if you watched what was it called? It was basically, I think it had Lonnie Anderson and Linda Carter. They were two detectives who were, I think I've mentioned this before, who were related to an ex-husband, both the same husband, who died and left both of them his detective agency. But everything was glamorous. Everything, you know, the actors and actresses looked, you know, good. But you contrast it, say, like in some of the shows in the 90s and early 2000s, you know, things were supposed to be edgier and rawer and, you know, characters weren't as clean cut and not so definitely, you know, there were shades of gray to their personality. You know, there were, you know, the idealistic perfect hero was gone, and now you had these cynical anti-heroes who did what they had to do, but maybe did it and or accomplished it in a way that wasn't, you know, considered to be the most respectable. You know, like beating up a suspect to get information. And you've always seen that throughout, you know, various stages of cinema and television and novels, like, you know, pulp novels, film noir, where you had kind of that, you know, that anti-hero-esque feel. But, you know, it's interesting. I just find it very, very entertaining to watch it.
We got to take a break because we have a sponsor, Roger.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. This episode of East Meets West brought to you by Ting, not Tinga, which is a very delicious Mexican dish, and not a sound effect, but Ting, T-I-N-G, a mobile service that makes sense. Comes to us from Two Cows. Those are the folks that bring you Hover.com if you register domain names with Hover. It's all about bringing billing clarity, usability, and big savings to mobile phone users. So if you've got a mobile phone plan that you're not happy with, one of the reasons you're not happy with it is probably because it's just too darn complicated to understand what you're actually paying for and why you're paying so darn much. Ting uses the Sprint network, which, by the way, is getting better all the time. They not only have WiMAX, so they have high speed, but they're also going to roll out LTE. So their service is going to be fast all over the place. And Ting does simple plans with honest, fair pricing that bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. If you use less than anticipated, you get credited the difference at the end of the month. No mobile phone company does that. Because when you're first thinking like, wait, everything's billed separately, so they're going to max me out on the charges. No. If you use more, you build the additional amount, but they don't penalize you for using more. It's not one of these things like, oh, you didn't guess right how many minutes you were going to use, so now you have to pay. No, there's no premiums. There's no penalties. You just pay for what you use. And they offer 4G Android phones through Sprint. Ting website has clear graphic snapshots of your usage by device, so you can actually know how much you're using. You can know how much you're going to pay. Easy access to billing information, lots of control over features, and lots of help content. Businesses and families can have unlimited devices on an account and can manage and track usage on each device. So again, it doesn't matter how many phones you have, you only pay for the service that they're using, whether it's data, whether it's voice, whether it's text messages. They don't care how many phones you have on the account. It's what you're using. That's what they pay you for. They've got all kinds of people on Twitter. If you do a search for Ting, you'll find all kinds of people talking. Customer back in February said, my Ting phone bill was $22 last month. That's almost exactly $100 less than it was with AT&T. Marketing firm in Boston with six people told Ting, we plugged in six together and saved an estimated $12,000 in annual savings. Plus, because they're run by Two Cows, because they've been doing this with Hover, they know about good support. You get no wait customer support, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So when you call, somebody picks up the phone. You don't get put on hold. They also have email support if that's more convenient for you, offering active discussion forums. They log customer feedback. They blog. They Twitter. Post-release notes. If you want to find out more, visit emw.ting.com. Try their savings calculator. See how much you might save over your current plan. And they have great phones. The LG Optimus, $155. HTC Detail, $395. They've got the Samsung Galaxy S3 over there. Just go Ting.com, emw.ting.com, and check it out. Save money and better management of your mobile phone usage with Ting. And if you go to emw.ting.com, actually, you save $50 on your first device that you buy from them. So check them out, emw.ting.com. We thank Ting for their support of East Meets West. They're unexpected and awesome support.
They are. It's a pretty awesome company. And I will say, if you're one of those, if you're shying away because you want the latest and greatest, come on. They got the Galaxy S3, and not just the 16 gigabyte version. They also have the 32 gigabyte version if you're like, super, I need the storage space, and I like downloading apps left and right. So you're definitely not going to be getting, you know, last year's models. You will have access to like the latest and greatest, which is awesome.
You're talking about the old-timey serials and the changes in characters, and it reminded me of some of the movies from the 20s, even some of the silent films before the ratings code was put in place, were pretty darn racy, even by today's standards. Definitely when I first found out about them in the 80s, they were super racy. And not just because they had divorcees in them, but there was sex and violence in those movies. Not as graphic as today, just because the technology wasn't as good as it is today at depicting things. But you can tell the intent in looking at them, and it's what caused the graphics code. Do you think we see cycles of this kind of, and I don't want to say it's all bad either, but this kind of like graphic violence, graphic sexuality, graphic depictions of real life, and then there's a backlash and things start to become a little more shallow, a little more one-dimensional to be safe, and then eventually that wears off and people start taking more risks and more risks till it builds up a backlash again. Seems like, yep, it just goes in cycles like that.
It definitely does. I mean, you know, the rating codes prevented a lot of gratuitous violence, but there was a lot of violence in a lot of the 80s evening shows, like The A-Team. A-Team, a classic example.
Oh, the nobody can die, but yes, you can do pretty much anything else to them?
Literally, they would empty out an entire van full of ammunition at these bad guys. They would set off explosions,
yeah,
have these wild car chases and jumps. No one did! No one! And you're thinking, as a kid, it's like, wow, either they're the most incredibly worst shots on the planet, or this is just the Three Stooges, you know, with guns. And what I found was that, you know, instead of talking, not to say that I'm some sort of peacenik, but like a lot of these situations, it's like, don't you think you're going a little overboard? Just to saw, you know, it's like, why don't you just frame him or whatever? Use your, you know, amazing A-Team, let's build it abilities and do a con. And that's interesting because you kind of have that style of show where I'm not sure what to call it, but it's kind of like a heist show in that there's a lot of planning and there's this build up to it and then the final execution. But you know, it with the A-Team, it was, let's build this device with this elaborate plan. And then, you know, B.A. Baracus will drive out in this contraption they built, you know, and they'll lob grenades made of coffee cans that they made in this guy's, you know, basement and just, you know, blow all the bad guys to hell. And then they would wrap them up nicely and the police would come and arrest them. Like, it's just absurd. But, like, as you moved into the 90s, I think it was, you know, the violence was, okay, I'm going to shoot this guy. It was more like, I'm a badass. And the violence wasn't like they shot him and the face exploded. But they would shoot them and show very little remorse. You know, before, yeah, they would have to show, like, you know, this is troubling me. I've killed someone. You know, was this? Didn't I have another option? You know, there was some sort of soul
search. I'm really sorry that I had to tie that person up and pistol whip them and torture them. Gosh, I feel bad.
But in the 90s, it's like I did what I needed to do to save, you know, the greater good. You know, the ends justifies the means. And that there definitely is that cyclical tone. I mean, the 70s, especially in the theaters, you know, people not familiar with American history, like the 70s, especially in like large cities like New York, Chicago, Cincinnati, L.A. I mean, crime was on the minds of a lot of people. I mean, I know my dad used to tell me about it. You would have to go to, my dad actually ran an apartment building here in San Francisco. And you would get this call from this one tenant who, you know, was like, oh, can you put these bars up on my windows and, you know, add this extra gate on my front door, like on the back porch door and all that. And movies like, you know, Charles Bronson movies were very popular because there was this guy who was, you know, doing what the system couldn't, cleaning up the town of the pimps, the drug dealers, the people who extorted the weak, you know, the bullies, people would use violence by giving a taste of their own medicine, you know, go through and just shoot them and kill them. And then something happened and the 80s came around and suddenly that kind of Charles Bronson, every man, I'm pissed off, but I'm a tough guy character, morphed into the Sylvester Stallone. I got muscles in places where I didn't think you could have muscles. And I'm literally like, you know, bullets bounce off me. I'm like Superman, except I can run through the jungle, you know, stripped bare to the waist and, you know, lob grenades and various items, dodging bullets without breaking a sweat. like you had the act. I think that was the decade of the action hero, and you know, again with the 90s, they became the anti-hero who did the sort of the same thing, but in a more grittier and more kind of shades of gray environment. In the 2000s, you know, now we have heroes questioning, even though they might be dark, like the Dark Knight. It's like, you know, there's a lot of soul searching, you know, with Batman. And so I think that will come around again. You know, it everything happens in cycles. Everything.
Well, it's always a reflection of society. And like you say, there was a lot more. I wouldn't even say there was a lot more worry about crime. Crime is still listed high up on issues, even as the crime rate continues to drop.
Although it did spike recently.
That's a good point, is that recently, and I think it's, there's some controversy about this, but I think it's still tied to the economy. I think crime and economy
go
hand in hand. And in the 70s, the economy was stagnant. And so that makes it harder for cities to staff their police forces. It makes it harder for people to resist turning to crime to make ends meet.
The lure of easy money.
It makes sense to me. And some of the stats bear it out. Some of them don't. So it is a question. But I do feel like if you look at the movies, it sort of reflects those worries and how serious they are. And in the 90s, crime was still listed very high, but the crime rate was plummeting. And it was because we had found more effective ways of policing, and more money was going back into police. And there was even with the early 90s recession, there was still much more money around in the economy than there had been in the 70s. And I feel like we're in a repeat of the 70s right now. I've been saying that for a couple of years. I've been saying it was coming even back in 2007. I'm like, we're headed for a stagnant decade. And I think that's what we're seeing. You have very slow recovery that stalls out constantly and causes many panics. And I think it's going to stay that way for several years. And I go back and forth. I hate to say it. It's going to stay that way for several years because, gosh, wouldn't we all like a nice, strong recovery? But at the same time, really what a slow recovery hurts is big enterprise, big business, big things, not just businesses, but big enterprises, big things that we can
do. Big organizations.
Yeah, big organizations. Government, nonprofit, for-profit, anything like that. It doesn't necessarily hurt your quality of life unless you're directly affected. Obviously, it hurts your quality of life if you're one of the 7-8% of the people who are out of a job. And I don't mean to be insensitive to that. But for those 92%, who are employed, they have a decent quality of life because there's not swings, there's not overpopulation, there's not too much money in the system that's all going to one sector and not you.
Yeah.
Doing a service job can pay enough to actually make a decent living because the prices aren't running away. Now, that was the problem they had in the 70s. You had inflation and stagflation. Exactly. So that was a horrible problem. But now we don't have stagflation yet. Hopefully we'll avoid it. And so prices are staying rather steady. And so it's like, well, it may not be the best job that I would want to get, and I'm not going to get rich on it, but it can pay the bills.
I can support
and so you get
my life.
Higher quality people in these jobs because they're not all getting sucked up into other sectors of the economy. Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say, oh, it's all roses and we should want a stalled out recovery. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm saying there are aspects of it that I don't think are horrible. They would be horrible if it was a depression, if we were in if we were actually still in a recession and if everything were going badly. But frankly, There's some things about it that there's some bad things about a boom that you don't feel right now. And so it's not the worst thing in the world to have a slow recovery, as long as it stays a recovery and it stays going in that direction. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Well, it's interesting because that's essentially the holy grail of economics, is to find a path
and balance. Yeah.
Is to find the balance, because, you know, even up until, you know, now, all economies are based, what you're referring to, a swing. You have a boom, what they refer to as a boom-bust cycle.
Right.
You have a boom in commodities, or you have a boom in internet companies, or you have a boom in real estate, invariably followed by a bust. And so, you know, the Holy Grail is, of course, to find a magic formula that you don't run these. You still have the, ideally, you know, of course, you can't smooth out all the cycles, but that you minimize the boom and you thereby minimizing the bust. And so, you know, trying to factor that in, unfortunately, you know, human nature being what it is, kind of makes that tricky. And, you know, even China, which has a very centralized, you know, government and kind of an economic policy, I mean, it's very difficult to kind of control the spending habits of your citizens. You know, you have different levers at your disposal, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have the control you think you have. And I think one of the big worries, and I think this is kind of the elephant in the room right now, is, you know, everyone's focusing on Europe, Western Europe, North America, or the U.S. In terms of, you know, economies that are limping along, but, you know, a lot of worry has been placed on China as well as a lot of the other BRIC countries that would be Brazil, Russia, India, also slowing, because, you know, the hope was that, okay, so Western Europe and the U.S. are on a downward slide. These other nations will be able to pick up the slack, you know, with the demand that you could sell to. But, you know, when they start slipping, everyone starts slipping, you know, who do you turn to next? You know, you just can't produce and sell to Martians or Venusians or anyone else. You can only trade, you know, within the countries of this planet. So when everyone's feeling and everyone's codependent, you know, it doesn't matter who gets affected. Everyone else is going to feel it. And so that's kind of the way right now. It's like, you know, is this going to snowball into something even bigger, you know, in the upcoming next couple of years? Because, you know, China has been so export dependent. I mean, their economy is based on the fact that they manufacture goods that they sell to other countries. Now, with the slowdown in Europe, which was their biggest trading partner, and the U.S., which was their next biggest trading partner, you know, they don't have those sales. And ideally, they would be able to sell to the domestic population, but they, you know, they can't. They don't have the same buying power as those two, you know, trading or economic blocks. And so, you know, what do? Do you just start pouring investment money like they have been into infrastructure projects, you know, into other make-work projects? And it's very difficult because there's so many countries that rely on China buying their goods. You know, resource commodity-dependent nations like Canada, Australia, South America like Brazil, and parts of Africa make money by selling ore, fuel, and other raw materials to China for them to manufacture and process into finished goods. And so, you know, if that happens, what happens to those economies? So it's all a very intricate web. There is really no place you can say, like, aha, I'm safe. You know, it doesn't matter if the whole world collapses, I'll be safe. You won't be.
So, well, that's why I'm hoping it's not a collapse,
yes,
of the world. But in fact, what we should be tuning for is how do we reduce these negative indicators? How do we bring unemployment below 5%? Let's not worry about making a boom happen. Let's worry about tuning down the negatives. And I think a sustainable economy that maybe only grows a few percentage points, but keeps all of the negative indicators reined in, is just as much of a success as a boom, because there's less likely of a bust.
That could potentially be true, but I mean that's, you know, that's the key. What's the formula to that?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. It's easy to sit here like, just fix the unemployment part and everybody's happy. How do you do that?
That's pontificate from our homes over the internet.
Totally. All right, well, that's it for this episode of East Meets West. Thanks again to Ting.com for their support. Let them know that you thank them for their support. Even if you don't, you know, decide that the carrier is for you, just let them know. Thanks on Twitter or wherever, on their blogs, on their forums. And thank you guys for listening. We really appreciate it. We do this entirely for fun, and we're glad that so many of you find it fun as well. Subbrilliant.com/EMW is the blog. You know, we haven't been calling out every post that we get on there as much as maybe we have in the past, but that doesn't mean we don't appreciate them. We read and love every single one of them.
Yeah, and the last two from Carlos and Brian are both very interesting, and I do recommend our listeners go check them out. They do offer a very a unique perspective on the issues that we have talked about in the past, and I think great springboards for discussion in the future as well.
That's it, Free Speech West. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.